Hello, this is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour session of Zero Point Radio. I'm currently in New Zealand and have been in New Zealand for about 2 months now, and will be here another month or so before returning to Ottawa, Canada. I was invited to New Zealand by the Theosophical Society to give some talks on my work on the physics and metaphysics of the secret doctrine. The secret doctrine is H.P. Blavatsky's classic 1888 masterpiece. The secret doctrine is composed of two books. The first is called Cosmogenesis, meaning the creation and evolution of the universe. And the second is called Anthropogenesis, meaning the creation and evolution of humankind on the planet Earth and within the cosmos. So Blavatsky's secret doctrine, published in 1888, was this profound esoteric book about the origins of the universe and then the origins and evolution of humankind. So, in my studies of the secret doctrine, I've become aware of the significance of what Blavatsky refers to as zero points. Now, by zero point, Blavatsky means a point so small that it disappears from the range of perception from a lower plane. Like you might imagine our huge universe, and if you followed our universe back to its origin in modern science, you would trace our expanding universe all the way back to a Big Bang explosion. And prior to that, the scientists traced the universe back to a point 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. This is a dimension of a singularity or zero point condition in modern physics. According to the uncertainty principle, one can only measure something to a certain exactness, which is limited by the uncertainty principle. So when we try to examine something at a micro level, it gets to a point, a zero point, where we can't differentiate further, because that element passes from our plane of perception into a higher dimensional reality. So zero points are like also these portals or passageways. Zero points connect the metaphysical realms above to the physical realms below. So it's like the causes of the creation of the physical world are really, we can trace them back, I maintain, to zero point sources. So this unusual idea that the universe emerged from a point source, this was explained by Blavatsky in 1888. She described a first point of differentiation. And any living cosmos has such a first point of differentiation. And so I would call such a first point of differentiation a zero point condition. So I'm, in my work, explained that both the larger cosmos, the macrocosm, and the microcosm, the individual living human being, both have zero point sources. Now, my primary interest is in the psychology of consciousness. And for many years, my work focused on what I call the heart doctrine. Now, according to modern science, neurologists and scientists believe that the human brain in the head somehow produces consciousness. And by consciousness, I mean that inner awareness of being that we all have within ourselves. So in a way, that's consciousness. And modern science has always assumed that the brain in the head somehow produces that consciousness, that inner awareness we have of being. And scientists have confused consciousness with thinking and other cognitive functions, which are known to involve parts of the brain. But scientists have never been able to explain what human consciousness is or how it's produced by the brain. And really, it's a complete unknown. It's like the most mysterious thing in the world in modern science. In the early 1800s or late 1800s, William James described consciousness as the most, quote, mysterious thing in the world, and it still is today. But the scientists assume the brain produces consciousness. Now, my background, I'm a psychologist and a clinical psychologist, and through my studies over time, realized that all of the religious and spiritual psychologies articulate the heart doctrine, that our true self, or our higher self, is really associated with the human heart. In the Gita, it's called the Jiva Atma, which is described as a point source of light or fire, a Jiva Atma. It's like a God spark, as Shirley MacLaine would call it. The Sufis call it a divine spark. So the idea in mystical teaching is that there is such an element, and it is associated with the human heart, rather than being produced by the mind in the head. So we relate the heart to the soul. Even the words heart and soul go together. But in modern times, there's been a complete denial of the significance of soul and spirit within psychology and the sciences. And we've assumed a kind of materialistic philosophy and think there's only the material world, which even in physics now, what we think of as the material world is nothing like how it presents itself to our senses. But aside from that, so instead of having a simple materialist philosophy, the spiritual psychology say that there are spiritual dimensions of existence, and a human being is ensouled to the mechanisms of the heart, and consciousness is related to light and the light of the heart, because the jiva atma within the heart is described as inherently self-illuminating like the sun. So in order to create the human holographic experience, there has to be an inner light source. So this jiva atma is this like point source of supernal light and fire, which provides a basis for creating the human holographic experience. And this element is enthroned in the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. It's like within the heart, there's a higher dimensional space, in a sense. And this monad, a divine spark, exists in this higher dimensional space associated with the physics of the human heart. So I would maintain that there's a science to all of what I'm trying to explain. And this concept that we, as human beings, do have a spiritual or divine nature, which is associated with the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. This is a very, very important idea within science. I'm not saying one should simply believe this as a religious belief or dogma. I'm saying that this is a serious scientific hypothesis which is suggested by the study of different religious mystical teachings. The idea that the heart is not simply a soft muscle tissue and a mechanical pump, this is within the teachings of Judaism and Kabbalah, in Christianity, in the Vedas, in the Tibetan Buddhism of the Dalai Lama, in the secret doctrine of Madame Blavatsky. Madame Blavatsky explains, the suns expand and contract through their own hearts. Each embraces infinitude. So it's we as living beings, life comes into us through the heart, and it expands within, without, from the heart center through into the body, and a depth of consciousness withdraws back into the heart. And so in the beginning, in the way we have the emergence of light from the heart and distributed through the body, and as all that light ingathers back into the heart at death, the heart actually functions as a black hole computer. And as the consciousness is withdrawn into the heart, It makes evident to oneself the patterns of one's life and all the quantum field information that was one's life is available to our consciousness as it withdraws into the black hole computer of the heart. So in that way, a heart can be seen as a black hole computer. So I'm interested in the serious study of these such concepts as I'm trying to explain about the heart doctrine and the zero-point teaching. My interest is in mysticism and science and how these relate and trying to understand these things within ourselves, because all of these principles have to be approached within ourselves. In the mystical tradition, it is said, "Know thyself, and thou wilt know the universe and the gods." So this suggests that the human being has some other hidden self which people ordinarily don't realize, and that we can strive to attain that. And the primary element in that is the awakening of the human heart. And this is the basis for the awakening then of higher faculties of the higher centers, and also the direct experiences of the different dimensions of the heart. There's a whole inner science to the heart. And different states of samadhi are based upon the awakened heart. Okay, so that's the idea of zero point and the heart doctrine, which are the main teachings I elaborate. My website's at www.zeropoint.ca. I'm going to invite in now my regular co-host and commentator is Jim Moffat, and I'll introduce Jim in a moment, and then after that we'll have another guest for about an hour and a half, and then Jim and I will wind up the show for the final 15 minutes. Okay, Jim, how are you? You there in Toronto?
Yeah, I am. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How's your weather?
I'm getting a bit of an echo here. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Just the first time we've spoken since the New Year.
We haven't spoken. It's been very strange here in Toronto lately, weather-wise. It was 16 degrees centigrade on Monday, which is, I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but 60 degrees, I think. So it's very, very peculiar.
Wow. Yeah, melted all that snow you had the prior week or so, right?
Yeah, exactly, because we've been freezing for quite a while, and then all of a sudden, very, very warm, so and lots of snow for Toronto, so it's been very strange.
Yeah, there seems more irregular weather patterns and anomalies. I mean, I don't really understand what's all the varied causes of that, like planetary changes, and then what they're doing in terms of weather modification, what different countries might be doing. It certainly seems more irregular kind of weather patterns.
Yeah, it seems things are, as you say, things are very erratic and a lot of cataclysmic events, it seems, in a lot of different places. I mean, it's very complex. I mean, even people who purport to understand it, I don't think most of them would admit that they don't really, it's hard to model these things, even with computer technology. It's very difficult. There's so many different variables at play. It's very complex.
Yeah. And as though it's not simply one factor anyway, I mean, nothing really is. It's a whole complex of different interactive factors, often people can't think, oh, it's one cause for everything, but, obviously, there's all different apparent contributor factors and such.
I was just going to say, it's interesting, because I was just thinking, it's like the Gaia hypothesis that the Earth is in some ways akin to an organism, like with a variety of different systems interacting and intelligence is interacting. And I think that's, that's something that, for instance, Gurdjieff said, 100 years ago. And I think there's reality to that. But also, it's interesting in thinking of man as a microcosm of the macrocosm, that in a way, you know, you could say the universe is like a great organism. You know, it's like in the 20th century, Sir James Jean said that rather than appearing to be like a great machine, the universe appeared to be more like a great thought. And I was talking to somebody about that, and they said, well, how about more like a great action? And I said, well, realistically, in a way, it's almost like it's like a great organism, you know, with all these different levels of complexity and intelligence operating, and you know, that's where the mystical perspective is so interesting, and trying to draw parallels between what occurs on the microcosmic level, the level of the human being, versus the macrocosmic level of the universe. It's very interesting parallels.
Yeah, and that's why it's so ideal, like taking the zero-point concept, which we know applies to the universe in terms of the universe emerging from the singularity out of the quantum vacuum, and then applying that whole framework of understanding to a human being, that similarly human beings might emerge out of the nothingness of the quantum plenum and emerge from a point source and grow as a cosmos from within without, from the zero point, just like the universe might. And that's something in the human being might withdraw without within back to the zero point level and even pass through higher dimensions of space and have other lives and such possibilities. So it's I think that zero point concept is, in a way, what most profoundly brings together that idea of looking for parallels between the microcosm and the macrocosm.
Well, I certainly think, I completely agree, and I think that really, that's an astonishing idea, and it, what's so interesting about it is that it does provide, the zero point hypothesis provides a framework for understanding that and developing that whole idea entirely consistent with the idea of the microcosm or the macrocosm. But then when you marry it to bring it together with the heart doctrine, I think it's even more profound, because it's not that you're locating this in the brain, but saying that rather that life and consciousness originates within the higher dimensions and manifests through the physical heart and through the higher dimensions of the heart and then the physical dimensions of the heart. And I don't know of anybody in consciousness research, I don't know anybody who really articulates that the way that you do, and I think that's what's really profoundly provocative about your work. I would say that it provides a model which, as you say, you're not asking anybody to believe this, but it provides a model which is utterly unique, and which in terms of just looking at it as best as I can understand it, it has such elegance to it and such, you know, it's such appeal to me on an aesthetic level, because it's so consistent with everything else I know.
Yeah, that's what I find it to be myself. It's just everything falls into place around it in a way. Yeah, I don't know anyone who articulates the same concepts as I'm arguing, not in the manner I do. Like, many people touch on aspects of it. I heard Greg Braden on Coast to Coast this last week, and he had some very interesting comments in agreement with what I teach in terms of the electrodynamics of the heart and the heart fields and such. But
I'm sorry, who was that?
Greg Braden.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I know Greg Braden.
Who was author of Awakening to Zero Point.
Right.
In his book, though, he deals with the zero point concept more in terms of cycles of time, and when kind of a cycle, a period of time comes to an end, it comes back to a zero point, and then a new phase begins, which is one application of the kind of zero point concept. But he doesn't explore the concept of zero points in terms of a human being having a zero point center. Even now, I don't think he has that element in his work.
Yeah.
So really the only place that one can get the zero point concept, I would say more, is in like Blavatsky or Kabbalist teachings and other esoteric sources. So my work is quite unique in that, in terms of trying to seek the synthesis of science and religion. Yeah, so how's your writing coming, Jim? Maybe you're writing a book more about trying to explain my views and kind of biographical a little bit too. I guess you're going through various phases of my life and what things I discovered and rediscovered and researched and and you're writing this up as the problem of God's contracting universe, as kind of a story about this scientist with an alternative view of the significant issues of science. How's your work coming, Jim?
Well, yeah, actually it's a little bit stalled right now because I've got so much work, other work, the writing I'm doing professionally, you know, the got to eat here these days, and it's been a bit of a problem lately. But it's interesting because, as you said, the title of that book comes from a book that you began I guess 1979 in reply to Carl Sagan's statement in one of his essays, A Sunday Sermon in Broca's Brain, where he says that he talked about the growth of natural explanations in science versus appeal to religious or spiritual or magical forces. And he says that it seems that as science advances, there is less and less for God to do. And this is sometimes called the God of the gaps, that as science progresses, God gets squeezed into the remaining gaps in scientific knowledge. And you took that statement and said, is this true? And proposed to write, in 1979, proposed to write 8 volumes of commentary based on mystical and esoteric teachings, the sciences and the pseudosciences or psychic sciences, and had this hugely ambitious project to reply. In the ensuing 25 years, or almost 30 years, I think that you don't use that title for any of your books anymore, but I think that realistically that's a good label for the entire corpus of your writing, is that it's addressing the problem of God's contracting universe. So in my book, I use Carl Sagan as an example of the proponent and upholder of the material mechanistic worldview in science as being the most comprehensive and reliable way of knowing reality. And I contrast that with your work one of the objects I have in writing about your work is to show how it's evolved, and that generally materialist scientists and skeptics have very dismissive and pejorative opinions about mysticism, and what I'm trying to show is that the mystical and esoteric tradition is every bit as complex and as intellectually challenging as anything in modern science in terms of understanding ourselves and the world. And so what I'm trying to show in part is how your own thought has progressed over those 30 years. Like I would say that you know, it grew in the initial stages very rapidly, and then you came to a point where you needed some sort of external shock, some sort of further development to carry your work over to another level, and then you went to another level, and another shock was required. And I'd say that in your case, the development of the heart doctrine and then the development of the serial point teaching has taken your work to a very unique level in terms of integrating the ancient mystical esoteric and traditions and modern science in such a way that this is a model of consciousness and being which is applicable to science, to spirituality and religion, to mysticism, to basically the knowledge and the understanding of all and everything. So that's what I'm pursuing. And what I'm working on right now, which is very interesting, I have a chapter where I'm trying to give an overview of some of the issues before I discuss Carl Sagan and Richard Dawkins on the God delusion, and Sam Harris, who's the author of The End of Faith, and Daniel Dennett, who also has Breaking the Spell about the sociological understanding of religion. What I'm trying to do is to show that really when people talk about science and scientific naturalism, they're speaking about a very specific understanding of what that means, and that really, if you really look at the history of how the material mechanistic worldview arose, and it's only about 300 years old, 350 years old, it's not the triumph of reason and rationality and empiricism over blind faith and religious dogmatism and magic. It's a very much more complex story than that. And really, when you really look at it, even in terms of modern science, if you look at the materialist mechanistic viewpoint, it's very good for making computers and solving certain problems on certain physical levels and describing things in great detail, but it's not a model that's applicable that really can explain the fundamental mysteries of life and existence of both ourselves and the cosmos. And you have to go beyond that model, and that's one of the things I'm trying to show is that. So the implication of all that
It's so interesting how all that ties back into this fundamental enigma of human consciousness. Like, even when I began writing that problem of God's contracting universe, my first point was that because we don't understand consciousness, this is such a profound mystery, and that because the issues of consciousness are then tied into the question of the existence of the spirit and soul in the human being. So it was kind of upon that basis that began this whole process of exploring mysticism and science and the new synthesis. Well,
yeah.
I know you've said from the gym that you've got so much material you're even seeing it as a two-volume set. So hopefully you'll find a publisher within the next year and get volume one of that out. I'd be most interested to read it myself.
Yeah, I'm really actually quite excited about it, and I'm starting to think that, you know, I could easily write three volumes on this because there's so many important issues that arise within this discussion, both, you know, in terms of spirituality, in terms of science, in terms of the history of science, in terms of the history of spirituality. It's a very, very complex question, but I agree exactly with what you just said, that it all starts from the idea that we have this fundamental, in modern thought, we have these fundamental mistaken ideas about the nature of consciousness. And once you realize that, everything changes.
Yeah. It's been quite a path, quite a rich life that we've had. I can't imagine living without an esoteric spiritual type of influence and search. Anyway, we should probably be moving along and introduce our guest. I'm going to just say a few things to introduce our guest. Our guest is from New Zealand, so there may be an extra time delay between he and I hearing each other, which sometimes made it difficult. The last time we had a guest on from New Zealand, there was that 3 to 4 second delay and made it awkward a little bit. Anyway, I have in front of me a magazine called Uncensored, and subtitled Challenging the Drivel of Mainstream Media. And this magazine, Uncensored, I've come across while being here in New Zealand. And to me, this is the absolutely most amazing magazine I've ever encountered, which explores freely all the truths and falsities of what's happening in the world in terms of the lies of 9/11, the chemtrails, the fluoridation of the water, popular political leaders and movements. This is an astonishing kind of expose magazine, and it's a high-gloss magazine. They're beautifully produced, and so I've been trying to develop a whole collection. I've got 7 of the first 10 volumes of this magazine. And I wrote to the publisher or editor, chief editor, Jonathan Eisen, and have had the opportunity to meet Jonathan. And before I invite him in, I'm going to just read, just to hear, get some sense of Jonathan's editorial perspective. This is from the newest Uncensored, from the cover, and this is a part of his editorial. He writes, okay, let's get this straight. The U.S. and the U.K. illegally invade a sovereign country. No, make that 2 sovereign countries, Iraq and Afghanistan. Kill millions of people and make 8 million people homeless refugees. All of this carnage is based on the lie that Saddam had WMDs, weapons of mass destruction, and a connection to Al-Qaeda, and that the Taliban were hiding bin Laden. I mean, really, the so-called war on terrorism is the biggest hoax of them all, raking in trillions of dollars of defense contractors who are waist-deep in human gore and blood. The American government, which the world once looked for moral leadership, is now engaged in torturing people wholesale, and yet it's the whistleblowers who are deemed unpatriotic. Now the U.S. is threatening Iran with nuclear war, even though Iran hasn't invaded anyone. So tell me again, who are the terrorists, really? Enough with the madness. The world has tried insanity, and it doesn't work. Really, it doesn't. And what's going on now, by any definition, is insane. The trouble is, it's becoming normal. Part of the editorial by John Eisen. So I'd like to introduce John. Are you there?
Yeah, more or less.
how are you?
Wait a minute. Are we encountering this 3-second time delay right now?
Yeah, we may be. Yeah.
Oh. Okay, well, I will wait 3 seconds before speaking.
Oh, no, I don't think we are.
Oh, good. Okay.
Good morning, John. Your words are jumbled to me a bit, so I'm having a hard time hearing clearly. But
that's because
anyway,
I'm drunk.
Welcome, John, and maybe you published 10 issues of Uncensored now. I must say you're a very brave man to be on the forefront of what's happening in the media today and exposing the kinds of stories you're exposing.
Was that a question?
It's kind of opening up for you to jump in and say something, sure.
okay, I understand that our voices have to be bounced over to Canada and then back to us before we can actually hear each other, which makes for an interesting kind of an experience. How's that? Did that come back to you all right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. So my opportunity to jump in here is it will be taken, and I thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Yeah, we do what we can with Uncensored, and the reason I got into it was because everything else was such drivel, which is why we have the little motto, exposing the drivel of mainstream media. I just couldn't stand it anymore. I've worked with in mainstream off and on for many years. I've had some of my best stories censored from 60 Minutes. I just couldn't stand it anymore. I thought, well, the hell with it, you know. Let's get something going here that could be a model for other magazines, or if somebody wants to, you know, take this magazine over, well, God bless them, they can bloody have it. As long as they continue with the editorial integrity, which I've tried really hard to maintain. We don't have any advertising to speak of, and basically it's a reader-sponsored effort here. But we've taken off pretty well here in New Zealand and Australia, where many people still have the ability to think and make up their own minds and think independently. However, we're not on sale on the newsstands in the United States and Canada, because the bookstores over there were too chicken shit to cover it, to sell the magazine. So if people want to have a look at it and see what we're up to, they can go online to uncensored.co.nz, or NZ as you say over there, and they can download anything they want to. We don't have a copyright on anything. It's all free. So have a look at it and download what you want to. We're living in very, very perilous times, and I think it's incumbent on anybody who can still think their way out of a paper bag to start standing up on their hind legs and giving them hell, Harry.
Well, you certainly stand out there at the forefront, John, and this is, your magazine is just like, it's like no revolutionary could be, afford to be without a copy of Uncensored, in terms of providing breadth of issues, like you talk about everything from chemtrails, fluoridation of the water, the political sector, the occult aspect.
Yeah, we're living in what one person is aptly called a pathocracy, all right? Which is the rule by people who are demented. They're psychopaths, all right? Let's call a spade a spade here, all right? This is completely nuts.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at this really good Paul Craig Roberts commentary on, and here we go. The phenomenon of pathocracy matures during this period. An extensive and active indoctrination system is built with a suitably refurbished ideology constituting the vehicle or Trojan horse for the process of pathologizing the thought of individuals in society, which is exactly what's happening. The goal is never openly admitted, which is forcing human minds to incorporate pathological, experiential methods and thought patterns and consequently accepting such rule. That's fucking brilliant. All right? And that's what we're seeing now. Nobody thought that the Bush-Cheney model would ever catch on without realizing what the insidious octopus-like dimensions and dynamic of the pathocracy really is, which is basically to infect everybody in the society. And which is why I say on the front page editorial that this is, you know, this craziness, this insanity, is becoming normal, and what we have here is a so-called civilization of enablers, where because of the pyramidal structure of the society, everybody's sort of aping the next level up in an effort to reduce cognitive dissonance, as you philosophy guys would say, or basically to suck up to the next level so that you basically don't get threatened and can succeed in a pathological situation. What the hell is that beep? Oh, I've got a call coming in, but I'm not going to take it. How's that? The fact of the matter is that the pathocracy really is there to infect everybody. And the challenge that we have here is not only to stay sane and to stay with the heart chakra, as you guys were talking about a few minutes ago, but to really let your consciousness have a look at itself. And the interruption of that process is at the very heart of the dynamic of the pathocracy. Do I make myself clear? If not, I'll do that one more time a little bit more clearly. It's the nature of the pathocracy or the idiot genius of this particular dynamic, of this particular infecting dynamic that actually cuts people off from their own heart chakra, from their own spirituality, and from their own soul, which is why you have millions of Indians right now doing a lot of yoga so they can kiss their ass goodbye. The fact of the matter is that we are living in an age which is aptly characterized as Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga is materialist darkness. Okay, you fellas are well aware. But the nature of materialism and this materialist darkness is to cut people off from their own sanity and their own potential. All right, and that's what we're seeing now, which is why it's so bloody frightening. Or, to put it another way, as the Chinese say, we are certainly living in interesting times. And what is our challenge? Our challenge is to clarify these things and to stand up as I'm not going to say enlightened, but I mean truly people who are trying to stand up for the true nature of the human condition, which is spirituality. And this goes on again and again and again. In your extended introduction, you said that this mechanistic worldview was only about 300 years old. I don't think so. I think this mechanistic worldview goes back millennia. In fact, my first take on it was on the 325 AD takeover of a really great spiritual movement by Constantine at the Council of Nicaea. All right, if that wasn't the triumph of the mechanistic worldview, I don't know what is or what was. But it goes on and on and on. This is the yin yang of the whole human condition, But you have to stand up on your hind legs and say, what are we doing this? What are we here for? Who are we? Why are we here? And if it isn't for truth and freedom, and justice, which are preconditions for the larger spiritual journey that we're taking, I think that we're wasting our lives, which is basically another part of the agenda of this pathocracy. But I've probably been talking enough.
You've covered a number of things that I might pick up on. A few things here. You mentioned the idea of freedom and justice, and it's funny, I'm a double Libra, so the symbol of the Libra is a symbol of the justice, and it's odd because it was only a year ago last March, so about a year and a half ago, that I discovered the truth of 9/11 when my 15-year-old son got me to watch a copy of the movie Loose Change. And I watched that movie once. And I'd always been apolitical and wasn't much in touch with what was happening in the world. And I just couldn't believe that movie. It was that that 9/11 was actually an inside job. And the evidence for it is absolutely undeniable. And I went from that movie to then I started searching out and watching and learning through the internet. And the more I learned, the more horrifying it is, because you realize Our whole political system, political, corporate, medical, educational, our whole society has been systematically infiltrated by these people with this sinister, hidden, evil agenda. And you call them what idiot geniuses. I mean, somewhere behind all this scheme of theirs is some kind of genius, but such a psychopathically disturbed genius. It's like an entity has no soul. They have no heart and soul. I see that's the controlling factor of this element in our society, who have schemed a way to enslave the human being and to poison people, to poison them in their food and in their air, and systematically, intentionally dumbing people down.
Well, but wait a minute. can I suggest something here?
Go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say that I would come back to the initial point made when you were reading the editorial, is that, and the point I think that our guest was making was that part of the problem is that you can talk about various cliques of evil geniuses who are engaged in all this kind of skullduggery, but there's a basic problem is that people don't want to even think about these things and can't even apply basic logic to question the premises of these acts that are committed in the name of freedom and democracy. You don't really have to be all that bright to understand that you can't go halfway around the world to start two wars and claim to be really upholding the standards of freedom and democracy. You can't, even if you accept that the premise that there's a terrorist threat to the United States of America, the whole idea of attacking a country to end it is completely illogical. The Israelis have been fighting the Intifada for, 20 years in a piece of land that's the size of a postage stamp, and they're not shy about pulling at all the stops, and they can't even stop that. So how are you going to stop an international terrorist conspiracy by waging a war in two huge countries that can't be conquered? I mean, that even if you accept the premise, you have to go beyond the saber rattling and the bloodthirst and question, well, is this even reasonable? It's not. Almost every basic premise is never questioned by the mainstream media, and so people don't even ask intelligent questions about these things. They just respond like little conditioned monkeys and don't even want to ask the questions.
Yep.
Well, I think
well that's the whole idea.
More clear.
Sorry.
Go ahead, John.
One of my favorite bumper stickers was I refuse to believe that I'm living in denial. And one of the things I've noticed over the years is that the pathocracy cannot exist as freely as it can, as it does, as it is. With an enlightened or at least informed polity, with a citizenship that is actively engaged on all levels. Consequently, the agenda is, as Chris said, is to dumb people down to the point where they can't think straight. And that's the function of mainstream media, to give people the idea that they're actually getting information and not being manipulated. So, which brings me to two things. One is the fact that they've actually captured the United States and the public of the United States in a way that makes Freud's nephew Bernays actually smile from beyond the grave. Freud's nephew was a guy who we should probably pay attention to for a nanosecond or so, because he was the man who actually started the whole current public relations idea behind mainstream media, and was able to actually get a lot of his ideas accepted and promulgated and part of the ongoing manipulation of public consciousness. Not to say that people weren't being lied to prior to his work, but he was able to bring a certain amount of subtlety and scientific rigor, if you will, to the issue of how best to manipulate people. When you get to the point where, as you were saying, people refuse to engage in not only that wonderful DACO loose change, but refuse to engage in anything that is potentially disturbing to their equanimity, to their sense of well-being, which is tenuous at best, then you have a situation where people are quite easily manipulated, because they just refuse not only to go and engage you in a logical argument, but refuse to believe in any respect that they're living in denial. My own family often in the past has told me that they just don't want to discuss that. They just, you know, it may be true, it may not be true, but they just can't get themselves to discuss it, which is part and parcel of an entire civilizational kind of a movement here, which dare I say, does not celebrate the potential of human consciousness, but is part of an agenda which is absolutely, I mean, not only interesting from a psychopathological point of view, but is heading us into some very, very serious times ahead.
Yeah, there's so many things to respond to. I think one thing is that it's so shocking how I think the patterns of history are coming out, that people are beginning to see that, like, this isn't just a problem with the United States or other singular countries. It's a whole deeper pattern of events brought about through a world elite, and it involves like the Bilderbergs and the other round tables and the Rothschilds and the financial and banking empires. These schemes, these things have been schemed, and this agenda has been advancing around the world to try to bring about a one world order under these kinds of evil genius psychopaths. And people can't grasp the entirety of it. And to do that, I mean, I know when I first learned about these things, I mean, it sent me off into quite elevated states of consciousness and kind of horror and fear and awakening and rapture and all these kinds of experiences that set off for me to expand my mind into the broader dimensions of what this evil is that's come upon the human race, really. The human race is in a severely dangerous and you know, kind of potentially cataclysmic time in human history.
Did somebody say rapture?
Well, I did, yes.
Well, that segues neatly into the use of religion, doesn't it?
Say again?
That segues neatly into the topic of how religion is used as a controlling mechanism for this whole thing. You said the secret word, you know, I couldn't resist jumping in there. And may I take this opportunity to plug a really good movie, which is available on the internet called Zeitgeist, Z-E-I-T-G-E-I-S-T, Zeitgeist, German word. But it's a really good expose of 9/11 and religion at the same time. I loved it.
Yeah, it's an excellent movie. As you say, it begins with 9/11, and then it goes a critique, a history of Christianity as a mind control, from
yeah.
a mind control perspective, and then it goes all through the history of Western society and the Rothschilds and the banking and the Great Depression and the different wars and how these things are being schemed by elites within our society and how the public is continually dummied down to believe the false kind of causes of war. It seems like every war is initiated by a false flag event or series.
So we know all of this now, Chris. We're getting pretty aware. I mean, thanks to the internet, which they haven't been able to close down as yet, although they're doing a pretty good job of censoring it, and infiltrating it, by the way. We've got all of that, but we are definitely still in a minority. What happens? How do we? The question becomes a how-to question, doesn't it? I've taken that question very, very seriously over the years, which is how does one person, oneself, make a difference? All right, and I think this is a question that anybody who's starting to wake up and go through the changes that you just described, which is, you know, shock and horror and rapture, elation, whatever, as awareness comes to us as we go and actually exercise our mind and start doing the research, and at each stage where we want to go into denial, where we go, this is maybe a little bit too much for me, I don't want to deal with it, what do we do at that particular point? And that's the choice that everybody has to make. The more knowledge you get, the more difficult it is for you to impose ignorance on yourself. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, this is, you know, the more you develop or evolve your own soul, the less able you are to go backward and to buy back into a society that your knowledge is now way beyond. All right? How does a person exist? Financially, if you will, how can you maintain yourself if you don't buy into the lies of the corporate establishment, which actually in most cases controls your own wherewithal, right? ability to make any money to pay the rent. And this is another obstacle that is thrown in the way of your own evolution, which is why a lot of people. My father discovered in 1948, that cigarette smoke, the carbon monoxide in cigarette smoke actually was one of the main causes of heart disease. This is 1948 through 1956. He was doing this work, right? So he had an epiphany there, and he tried to publish his findings in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which of course turned him down flat. at which point he published in the Canadian Journal of Medicine, and he was a graduate of the University of Toronto, by the way. So I have a deep and abiding connection with you Canadians. What he found was that advertising revenue coming into the Journal of the American Medical Association came thanks to the good offices and auspices of the American Tobacco Institute. This is where I first began to suspect that science and medical science especially was not all that it was cracked up to be, and that there was something else going on here that maybe I should take a look at as a budding journalist. So I started doing that in the 1960s, or earlier, 60s, and found all sorts of suppression going on of all sorts of medical discoveries and nutritional discoveries that were being relegated not only to the back burner but actually pushed off the shelf entirely because they conflicted with the dominant paradigm at the time, which is still the dominant paradigm, which is basically not evidence-based medicine, but religious-based medicine, which is as Robert Mendelsohn said, medical science is neither an art nor a science; it's a religion, and he was absolutely right. What I discovered along the line, which basically is some of which is summed up in a book I did, which, if you don't mind my plugging it for a moment, it's called Suppressed Inventions and Other Discoveries, which is available from Amazon. Suppressed Inventions and Other Discoveries has a lot of stories about cancer cures that were suppressed, Rife and Hoxie and Max Gerson and people like that, who actually were discovering cures for cancer and having their head handed to them as a result. The fact of the matter is that... What? Go ahead. Uh-oh.
Oh, sorry. I really like that about Uncensored, is that you had information about alternatives, like alternative treatments for cancer. You have emergent findings in areas of medicine, and you have a lot of valuable information in there that people can incorporate into their lives very simply. Like, I started using hydrogen peroxide, and you have a dandelion root thing in there for cancer, and you have a lot of valuable medical information. And it also points out how much the pharmaceutical companies and the medical community have been enlisted into the kind of schemes of these elites. That's what's kind of horrifying, is when you see, oh, the medicine is a complete fraud. In a way, the evidence they provide for the vaccinations and flu shots and other drugs, they're never properly tested. They hide all the adverse studies that show adverse effects, and they essentially control those bodies which are supposed to regulate them. Like, it's a complete fraud, all the kind of scientific basis for the pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
And they suppress anything that might be valuable to people. They intentionally want people not to be able to have vitamins and other nutrient supplements. They actually want to make people sick intentionally. It's inconceivable.
Well, on those lines, there's always the interesting, whenever anybody talks about cancer research and as John says, there's been all sorts of alternatives to mainstream cancer treatments, and cancer treatment is one reviewer I was reading recently said, essentially it's still the same as it was 40 or 50 years ago, you know, cut it out, burn it out. But, you know, the best illustration of the politics of cancer is Linus Pauling, who had won two Nobel Prizes, one for chemistry, one for peace, almost won a third because he almost beat Watson and Crick to the discovery that the double helix for DNA. Tried 8 times, I believe, to get $100,000 to research vitamin C in cancer cures. And, you know, $100,000 in cancer research is like taking it out of petty cash. It's not even nickels and dimes, it's pennies. And he got turned down 8 times, you know. And even more interesting is that subsequent to his finally getting some funding, I heard a guy on talking about the fact that really his research has never been done because he was talking about delivering vitamin C in liquid form in injections rather than taking it in pills and capsules. And he said, really, there are preliminary studies that have been done on cancer with vitamin C that were very promising and were never pursued. You know, it's just like it's inconceivable. Like more people make a living researching cancer than actually die from it each year.
You're absolutely right. The most interesting example of this is the Klenner report from 1948, which was published in the Southern Journal of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia, where Klenner actually was delivering 25 grams of vitamin C intravenously, not an injection, by the way. It's IV, and I've done it many times. To people who came down with polio, and he did a very, very rigorous study with people who contracted polio, and he found that the people who got intravenous vitamin C, 25 grams for about a week, had absolutely zero cases of paralysis. Consequently, he published this in the respected medical journal of the time, and was actually invited to deliver the paper before the 1949 annual convention of the American Medical Association before he was stopped. Everybody in his research team signed on to his conclusions except for a guy named Albert Sabin, S-A-B-I-N, and Sabin said it was all bullshit because he was working on a vaccine at the time. However, in 1954, the Nobel Prize winner that year was a Hungarian by the name of Albert Szent-Györgyi. I hope I pronounced his name right. And Györgyi actually found that why vitamin C worked. And against viruses, and this is virtually any virus, and it worked because it stole electrons from the virus, and he wasn't even sure that vitamin C was a traditional vitamin at all. He had no idea what the hell it was, but it actually robbed essential electrons from the polio and other viruses and rendered them completely useless. Dormant, whatever the word is. It deactivated them, that's the word.
Could you repeat that?
And he won the Nobel Prize in 54. Linus Pauling was one of my heroes. He died at the age of 94, by the way, and was advocating about 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day as a maintenance dosage because the human being is unable to make vitamin C, unlike most other animals. I think guinea pigs are the only exception. Vitamin C turns out to be one of the most essential vitamins, not only for the prevention of scurvy and other diseases like that, but as a actual cure for viral infections. And if you'll notice these days, gentlemen, the big scare on the horizon is the H5N1, bird flu, right? This bird flu virus supposedly is a hemorrhagic virus. The reason it's hemorrhagic is because it rapidly depletes vitamin C from the system, and what you're getting is almost an instant scurvy attack, which is why the tissues start bleeding. However, there's only one person that I know of, in New Zealand at least, has even broached the idea of intravenous vitamin C as a way of treating people who come down with this and other this bird flu and other and other flus. And that this is tragic, and it's part of a system that is geared more toward the maintenance of disease rather than for finding actual and implementing the cures that they do find. It's ridiculous. It's just absolutely silly. I don't know why I, you know, I'm still in this, but I'm just hardwired to bring these facts to the attention of the people who might come across this magazine. But these are facts, and I the reason I call it uncensored is because if anybody wants to dispute any of the stuff in the magazine, they're more than welcome. Our pages are open, all right? Everything is hypothesis. If you want to argue with me, fine, argue with me. Don't call me names, just argue with me and I'll publish your stuff. I even published a two-page or maybe even a three-page letter by a Christian evangelist who thought that I was, you know, anti-Christian or something, and he wanted to show me that that this Christian stuff was the straight skinny. So I published his letter, and after that I had a lot of readers wondering if I had converted. I said, hell no, but the guy is welcome to make his argument. And so, for that matter, is the CIA or any of these other intelligence agencies. You know why they have to call them intelligence agencies? Because nobody would know that they were intelligent unless they had that name on them. But yeah, the fact really. Of the matter is that we are, in fact, an open publication and are here to debate the issues. So let the games begin.
Well, it's like no one on the other side, in a way, ever wants to argue. All they do is hide. Like, they just hide the evidences and just deny. They never come into the public forum to tackle issues and address the issues. I mean, that's just not what happens. Like, because the evidence is so against them that in a way, they don't respond. That's how they just live in the denial and
well, that's the first thing they teach you in in political context these days, is that you don't buy into the premise of the other person's argument, so you just bypass it. And I would say that's basically what political discourse consists of in most of the Western democracies now, is just let's set up a whole bunch of phony questions and ideas and pound people with them and ignore the real issues and ignore any kind of dissenting viewpoint. Hey, by the way, did either of you guys hear the other day, and I mean, my first reaction with the speedboat thing in Iran was, geez, this is just like the Gulf of Tonkin, another phony event to start another war. But did you happen to hear the Republican debate in which, I don't know where it was, but it was... it was played on As It Happens, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's public news program, and it was really funny because the commentator sort of set it up and said, that this is the Republicans, and sort of started out by saying, this is the replies to this, the question about whether or not the commander had acted appropriately are going to blow your mind. And Huckabee started off with some sort of bizarre rant about this whole thing and ended up and said that these guys, if they challenge the United States, we'll see you in the gates of hell. Sort of the basic, we'll assert our moral superiority by blowing you off the face of the earth. And so then I went back to the commentator, and I don't know, another candidate commented, and she said, surely there must be somebody in this party who has some sort of a reasonable opinion. So they played Ron Paul, and Ron Paul is great because he said, let's not get carried away, and let's not take this out of context and everything. And then it went to Mitt Romney, and Romney said, well, thank you, Mr. Paul, for reading from Ahmadinejad's press release, basically saying you're a traitor because you're espousing the Iranian position, Just, it was incredible. It's just like, is this the latest from Joseph Goebbels and Nazi Germany? I mean, it was just incredible, the whole thing. And Ron Paul, the one person who made any sense, and the audience hooted when Romney made that comment, it was just amazing.
When Romney or Paul?
When Romney, they were yelling approval, like, great, you put that guy in his place.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it was frightening.
Oh, my God.
It was totally frightening.
Yes. And then they can go out on the street corner and wave the little American flags made in China.
Yeah. By slave laborers.
But there is a very serious issue behind this, of course, but beyond that is the startling fact that the only thing I think that's keeping us out of us being the West, or you know, the United States, out of a preemptive nuclear strike against Iran is the American military.
Yeah.
And Cheney and Bush have been trying for a few years now to get the Joint Chiefs of Staff on side, and they haven't been able to do it. And the latest NIE report, which says that basically Iran, if it ever did stop working on a nuclear weapon in 2003, was a spanner in the works of this particular agenda. And I hope it. It continues because the American peace movement has been completely taken over and has become a Bush enabler itself. And I'm sad and chagrined to say, but what we have here is a very interesting scenario whereby the American intelligence agencies, I guess, have gotten up on their hind legs and have told Bush and Cheney that their little plans to start a nuclear war are at least on hold, and they. This is why I think they're getting increasingly desperate, and which is why they staged this thing in the Straits of Hormuz. It's so ludicrous that there's no words to describe it, and except that the Americans are so stupid now they still believe what they hear from a controlled media. It's just astonishing. So if there are any billionaires or millionaires out there who would like to publish uncensored, for Christ's sake,
yeah.
Tell them to get a hold of me.
Yeah.
Oh, mate, it's something. Wait, how are things in Canada? There's some very good Canadian websites, by the way, how are things with your controlled media over there?
Well, two people own all the newspapers in the country, so it's a bit of a problem.
Well, you have something called. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just.
All the main Canadian media are controlled by the same people. And CBC seems to have a bit more independence, perhaps, but all the CTV and all the main radio stations and TV stations, none of them are telling the people the truth about the truth of 9/11, nor are they exposing so many other factors, like the issue of chemtrails, the issue of fluoridation. I mean, the media don't address any of the significant issues of the day.
Well,
they dummy people down through creating these trivial little stories that they'll. It's like a disinformation and distraction.
Who's the major? In the United States, about 70 to 75% of the large national media are Zionist controlled. Does the same hold true for Canada?
Well,
same news networks, like Reuters and the Associated Press.
What's that?
These two major news reporting services, which are controlled by the Zionist elites, and those are the sources for the main Canadian media.
I'm not sure what the Zionist part is, but I think it's more actually economic. But in Canada, I mean, the Asper family, which is one of the major holders, is incredibly pro-Israel and incredibly unbalanced in the representation of what's going on in the Middle East, amongst other things. So, I mean, that's one source of disinformation for sure. Here's a question I have for you guys. What's the deal with fluoridation? Whenever anybody talks about fluoridation, the first thing I think of is our precious bodily essences from Dr. Strangelove. I mean, to me, like, the whole fluoridation thing is, I always associate it right-wing nuts who thought that the government was poisoning them in the 50s. Like, what's the problem with fluoridation? Isn't it good for your teeth?
Oh, you got to be kidding.
No, I mean, what's the problem with fluoridation?
Well, I mean, I listened to 26 minutes of you talking about consciousness.
Yeah.
And believe me, I really tried to stay with the plot there. But the deal with fluoridation is that it is one of the most toxic elements in the periodic table, and one of the effects that it has is to turn off your cerebral cortex.
How?
Why don't you do a little bit of Googling yourself and find all of the scientific papers that corroborate the previous statement, of which there are hundreds now, including on Canadian scientist whose name escapes me temporarily, it has, yes, how interesting that they did that in the 1950s. They did set up a straw man, okay? And that straw man was the John Birch Society, and the straw man was the right-wing so-called kooks who didn't want this wonderful new element that had been found to be put in the water supply, right? However, what they weren't telling you was that at that particular time, the United States government was in a bit of a litigation problem with people who whose farms were getting poisoned and whose animals were dying from the fluoride, which was essential to the manufacture of nuclear weapons. There's been some very, very, very interesting pieces done over the years. The United States government desperately needed the fluoride to continue. So what happened was they hired a tame scientist who came up with the idea that fluoride was good for your teeth and could prevent tooth decay. However, they canceled a safety study that was done in upstate New York that was supposed to last 5 years. When it looked as if that there were some serious health problems that were consequential upon the addition of this toxic element. And trust me, fluoride there is no known need in the human physiology for fluoride. None. Zero. Zip. Okay? And in fact, the head of the New Zealand Dental Association did a study that showed that he did an epidemiological study. His name was John Colquhoun in the 1960s that showed that cities that did not receive fluoride in their water supply had fewer cavities than the cities that did. He was summarily dismissed from his position. But the argument that I choose to stand or fall on is, regardless of whether or not fluoride is good for your teeth or not, it is non-dose-related mass medication and contravenes every human rights law and principle that I know of. Non-dose-related mass medication is something out of the Nazi Germans and, in fact, was first used in Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in concentration camps to keep the populations quiescent. Does that begin to tell you why it's being used today?
Well, it's got all kinds of adverse physical and mental health effects. I mean, I think that's evident from studies that I've reviewed in your magazine and through the internet. It seems to cause scarring and marking of the teeth. It causes bone cancers in younger boys particularly. And you mentioned it dummying us down. There's a broader term. Is it neuroexcitatory toxins? Is that a term you're familiar with?
No, fluoride is not an excitotoxin, MSG,
no,
for example, is. What fluoride does is put your brain to sleep.
Oh, yeah.
And the Chinese have actually proved
cortisol.
That. I'm sorry.
Yeah, saying it reduces cortical activity. And yet here we are in New Zealand. I'm in Auckland sometimes, and the water's fluoridated. It's fluoridated and it's chlorinized. Fluoridated. And can you absorb fluoride through your skin? So when you shower and you're getting covered with fluoride?
Yeah. Yes, you can.
Yeah,
do
so
not
you cannot,
drink the tap
you
water.
Actually absorb it.
Yeah. Do not drink the tap water in Auckland. Definitely not. And as far as our Canadian friends are concerned, no, this is not a Dr. Strange Lovian kind of beat up on we are not kooks. The science is there, and virtually every European country has removed it. And Japan as well has removed it from their water supply.
From their water?
Reason. Yep.
Really?
Oh, good.
Yep.
Good.
Really. However, the Western so-called democracies, like England,
yeah,
Canada, the United States, Australia, and New Zealand have been pushing it and intensifying its use precisely for the reasons that I just gave. And it has nothing to do with your health or the health of your teeth. The fact of the matter is, as Chris just said, bone cancers, they have known that fluoride causes osteosarcomas since the 1950s. They have known that. It is a carcinogenic element.
Wow.
But they don't give a shit.
Go
ahead,
Chris. I was just going to say that kind of reminds me, this always kills me, but there's an ad for a popular breath mint that in North America that used to always go, and it had just a drop of retin. And I was talking to my doctor one day, and he says, well, retin's a known carcinogen, you know, and so they're putting just a drop of a known carcinogen in a breath mint, you know. And he said it's like...
Yeah, homeopathic remedy for you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another thing that is explored in Uncensored is aspartame. You write about that, Jonathan. Maybe you could say something about that, because that is so widely used in all the soft drinks and diet drinks. And
in the 1970s, 300 scientists from the United States FDA, when it was still vaguely independent, wrote a letter to Donald Rumsfeld, who was at the time the head of Searle, which was the company that was trying to push aspartame onto the American market. And they said, this shit's poison. No, we're not going to certify it. And so after a certain amount of judicious arm twisting, the FDA buckled under, and Rumsfeld made a fortune on it. The fact of the matter is that aspartame is a neurotoxin, and if you want to Google up some of the more interesting stuff on it, you can look at Dr. Blaylock, and he is a neurosurgeon who has written extensively on the dangers of aspartame, and Betty Martini, M-A-R-T-I, just like the drink, who has a group that they've been trying like hell to alert the world to the dangers of aspartame. And willy-nilly, the fact of the matter is that you remember Michael J. Fox? He was a spokesman for he was an actor in Back to the Future, and he was a spokesman for Diet Pepsi.
Right.
The unfortunate part of it, one of the reasons you don't see too much of Michael J. Fox anymore is that he contracted Parkinson's disease at the tender age of 30-something, and sure enough, diet sodas containing aspartame, and they all do, are responsible for that. I should say allegedly responsible for that. Oh, excuse me, we might get sued. However, the science is all there, and it's been there for 30 years. Nevertheless, governments like this government in New Zealand here is pushing all the schools to sell diet drinks in their soda machines, so that the kids don't become obese. The fact is that aspartame actually encourages the craving for short-chain carbohydrates, so that when you go to your McDonald's or other fast food outlet, you drink the diet drinks, you're actually telling your body, fooling your body into thinking that it wants more of the crap that they can sell you. And that's why you see so many obese people drinking diet drinks. That has nothing to do with losing weight. It has everything to do with gaining more weight. How interesting. Everything they tell you is a lie. It's just outrageous. But back to your fluoride comment, you should definitely do some homework on that, because I'm right. However, if you find that I'm not right, you can always write a letter and publish it. The situation is dire. And what we have here is a cancer epidemic, an obesity epidemic. Basically, this is the human race is ripe to be harvested.
Yeah, we're being led to slaughter. That's what's been happening, and all these things have gone on outside of our awareness, and we've been intentionally deceived by the media, and that the governments have sold out really to the corporate elites. It's like we think we have democratic countries, but really the politicians have been bought out or sold out.
One of my favorite authors is Lloyd Pye, P-Y-E. Google him up sometime. Lloyd Pye wrote a book called Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Yeah.
which is the best. I wanted that title for something I was doing, and then Lloyd went and, you know, he published before me, and God bless him for it. I published his stuff in Uncensored, because Lloyd Pye is one of the most brilliant researchers around. Lloyd's major work for the last 8 years has been to verify to verify the fact of something he calls the Star Child skull. And if you want to really get into the high strangeness realm, have a look at the Star Child skull sometime, because then you'll find out a little bit what's behind the veil here, okay? I didn't want to do this on this particular show, but the opportunity presented itself, and now I'm going to come out of the closet here, because I've been wondering for many, many years what the actual dynamic of the interaction is between the human species and the our off-world brothers and sisters. Okay, what Lloyd Pye has done, and he's done an absolutely brilliant job of this, is to take this skull, which is 900 years old, and subject it to every test that he could possibly afford. All right, and what he's found is that it's the first instance of a hybrid human hybrid alien skull. If this mows your lawn or floats your boat, I would suggest that you have a look at his work. I would strongly recommend that you have a look at his work, because there's something else going on here, other than the craven appetites of a materialist elite. There's something else going on here, and I think that it has a lot to do with our space brothers and sisters. Before you start thinking that I'm some sort of a kook or whatever, have a look at what this guy and the scientists who have assisted him to identify the actual structure of this particular skull have to say.
Yeah, I mean, it seems quite reasonable to me that we humans have been involved with other alien species even through our history, and we find references to things like this in the Bible and other ancient texts. So I don't find it difficult to concede that there are alien races involved with us on planet Earth, and even behind, associated with the elites and all these terrible things that are being done on the planet. like it seems that there are likely various alien agendas being worked out simultaneously with our own.
Well, maybe.
I think we've gone beyond your friend over in Canada, Chris.
Well, no, I read quite a bit of material along these lines. I'm neither a believer nor a disbeliever, but I mean I think there were other possible explanations of not necessarily extraterrestrial but extra-dimensional that there are different forces at work. Big questions, and each case has to be sort of taken on its own merits. Like, I don't know, and I'm quite happy to say I don't know. But I just wanted to, first of all, everything you know that is wrong, I think comes from the Fire Sign Theater from the 60s comedy group.
That's right.
Comedy group. Yeah, but anyway, I don't know if Jonathan, if you're familiar, I mentioned on a previous program, I just want to mention this book. It's by a guy named James Aronson, and I think it was written in the mid-70s, called The Press and the Cold War. And it's actually not just about the American press and the Cold War. It's actually about the American press in the 20th century. Anybody wants to see how the situation we're in now is neither unique nor unparalleled should read this book if they can get a hold of it. I'm sure it's out of print, but it's a brilliant expose of how the elites control the media and control the story and really perpetuate myths about virtually every war that the United States has been involved with in the 20th century, specifically the one that really shocked me because I kind of had always bought the party line, was what actually happened in the Korean War and how F. Stone had gone to famous American muckraking journalist had gone to England during the Korean War and started talking with European correspondents and got a very different explanation as to what had actually started the Korean War. And he started looking into it, and he thought he was looking into it to kind of expose the faults in the reporting, and found out that really the story that these people were telling in Europe was much different from the one that was being told in America, and was actually the right story. So he, of course, wrote a book Americans publishers refused to publish, basically exposing all the lies behind the beginning of the Korean War, and that it wasn't the result of North Korean communist aggression at all, and that it really, just like Vietnam, it was staged and provoked by American forces in Korea.
Yeah, I used to work for I.F. Stone.
Oh, really?
I sort of apprenticed to him. He was my hero as well, he worked me harder than any other boss I ever had before or since. I was a great fan of his, and in fact, when he turned 80, he started studying ancient Greek so that he could write a book on the death of Socrates and
right.
read Plato in the original. And he wrote a book called The Death of Socrates, which is one of the landmark books of all time in terms of political thought. And you should not miss it. The Death of Socrates, one a very, very brilliant book. Hats off to I.F. Stone, Izzy Stone, as we used to call him. A great journalist who was sort of a father figure to me, I suppose. Indeed, you're right. As far as the ET is concerned, it's all interdimensional, yes, sure, but interdimensional with some physical attributes, yes, absolutely. What do we make of it? I don't have a clue, except that they've been around a long, long time, and in a recent issue of the magazine, I have a picture of one of these little guys that was carved on... along with some other hieroglyphics in ancient Egypt.
You had an interesting picture in the latest Uncensored showing a little gray peeping out behind George Bush when he was giving an interview at the White House. You know, that was apparently published on CNN, Jonathan?
Yeah, that's right.
And that was an actual image taken from CNN. I would like to see the footage of that, like the
yeah.
extended version with it, because it does look like a little gray just in behind Bush.
Yeah, they've been around for a long, long, long time, and maybe as Lloyd Pye thinks that that it's the whole debate between the creationists and the evolutionists is complete bullshit. It has nothing to do with either of them.
Yeah,
he says that we're the result of some interesting genetic experimentation, and he's got some evidence to back that up.
I just wanted to get back to one thing further about I.F. Stone that's really interesting, which I think pertains to what we're talking about credulity and belief in the media and opening your eyes and your ears and your heart to what's actually going on. During the 50s, he was a target of the McCarthy witch hunt, and he became hysterically deaf, and he was doing congressional reporting at the time. And he couldn't go and listen to Congress speak because he was deaf. So he had to get copies of the transcripts each day and read the transcripts. And what he found in reading the transcripts was it was sort of like very illuminating. You can correct me if I'm wrong about this, Jonathan, but this is a story that I've heard that he started to read and he started to see all the contradictions when he was reading that he had missed when he was reporting and that other reporters were missing because they were just sort of following along in a linear way and recording what was being said. And he started to see all the contradictions and backtracking and checking other transcripts and it seeing that, you know, this is inconsistent, this isn't illogical at all. And it really was a transformative moment for him in terms of being a congressional reporter. Do you know anything about that, Jonathan? Do you know that story?
I know it only too well, because one of my jobs was to go around to all these damned offices and pick up the transcripts for him.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. And a small world, hey, Chris? And then
yeah.
that was for about 6 or 7 hours a day. And then I was on a 15-hour day, and then for the rest of the day and night, I would have to read this shit. And he would teach me how to pick the stuff apart, or what they would call deconstruct things, and until the point was reached where I was becoming he was becoming deaf and I was becoming blind, I remember it all too well, and he would excoriate me mercilessly. What, you've only worked 14 hours? Why, well, I've been working 18 hours, and this is a guy in his 70s. You know, and yeah, I remember that. And I would come into these congressional offices or wherever, the State Department. Yeah, oh yeah, this is it. And pick up a whole pile of stuff. I mean, phone books full of stuff, man. And he would go. Stone wore glasses as thick as Coke bottles. And you know, now I'm in that stage myself, but probably for similar reasons. He taught me a great deal. He was right on the button. And all during the Vietnam War, he would expose these bastards for what the hell they were doing to this poor country. You know, wherever he is now, man, you know, I hope he's getting some rest.
Well, I know we've got about 10, 15 more minutes with you, Jonathan. I did have a couple things more I wanted to touch upon. Just one was, I think the most horrifying story I've ever read in Uncensored was produced last year, the January of 07 issue, and it was this article about the massive underground bases of the American military or the elites through the states and some descriptions of those of places where there were aliens and such. Do you know the article I'm referring to? That was a totally shocking story.
Right.
Have you had other kind of sources of confirmation of those, or is that pretty widely documented?
Of course I have. Certainly I have.
Yeah.
Certainly. There was one of my friends, a UFO researcher, who came down to New Zealand in 1997, corroborated that for me, and actually knew one of the people who was responsible for the tunneling. They have a really gigantic tunneling machines that can turn the rock into glass, and they do all sorts of wonderful high tech things. His report to me was that at the time they had 128 underground cities in the United States, all connected by high-speed rail, or those tube things, the vacuum tube thing. Each of those cities could house many thousands of people. My thinking, and this is a hypothesis at this particular point in time, is that the warning came about these earth changes many, many, many years ago, which people... many people think are the result of excess carbon dioxide poured into the atmosphere as a result, this anthropogenic thing that Al Gore's been hooting on about, apparently is not true. That, by the way, was a very interesting thing, because I started out this particular issue of global warming. I said, okay, well, let's have a look at it, and by the time I had reached a certain plateau, I realized that global warming was occurring on Mars, Jupiter, Triton, and one or two other planets and large moons in this particular solar system. As strong as my telescope is, I couldn't detect any cars on any of these other planets. And that made me go to the next stage, which was to ask why it was that all these other planets were experiencing global warming, together with the Earth, and what was the true nature of the phenomenon. Well, the jury is still out, as far as I'm concerned, which is not my way of excusing the phenomenon of shitting in your own nest, which this particular species seems to be rather good at. I think that we should take the precautionary principle at this late stage, if we possibly can, which is to shut down all of the things that are polluting this biosphere, but in the meantime, to acknowledge that these other planets are undergoing a similar thing, and possibly the sun has something to do with that. I think that it's important to have a look at the net and see what geoengineering is all about, if you want to punch in for something that's very, very interesting. Because
geoengineering.
Geoengineering, yeah. That's getting away from the particular point that you asked about, which was the underground cities. I think that this planet is in for a major shock in of the very, very near term, which is why the underground cities have been prepared for shall we say the elite in there and their lovely little families.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they might end up making nice mass graves for them. You never know. I mean, I'm sure there's kind of safety risks underground as well.
Yeah, it was a shocking article.
The guy who wrote that
had an attempt made on his life, actually.
Yeah,
or maybe he did. Maybe they did kill him. I'm not sure. All right.
This idea that, that even our continents are honeycombed with these underground cities and passages linking them. Like, I read one place that these underground little trains through these tubes could travel at Mach 2 or something. Had you come across that, Jonathan? The speed of Mach 2
I don't know how fast they go. I don't even know that they exist, all right? I do have some very interesting and very incriminating photographs, some of which I've published. I do have a first-hand report by a guy named Wendell Stevens, who was a United States Air Force colonel, who had first-hand knowledge of this. Stevens, the PTBs have done their very, very utmost to discredit Stevens, but he stands up pretty well as far as I'm concerned.
If, Dr. Giesel also has also confirmed this. I think you're familiar with Dr. Giesel's work as well, Jonathan.
Refresh my addled brain.
Well, he was a doctor. He treated victims at the Oklahoma bombing, where he said they had radiation burns, and
he
worked with the military. He worked in underground bases and described these. Maybe that's where I got the figure that these underground transit moved at such high speeds was from Dr. Deagle. And he was saying, I guess the biggest of these centers is the Omega Center somewhere, Arizona, or somewhere in the Midwest of the States. I forget, Colorado, perhaps. The
Omega
Center, which is the biggest.
There's an awful lot of stuff about what lies beneath the Denver airport, if you really want to have some fun.
Yeah. Well, but, so it's, as you say, these groups may be kind of developing something in anticipation of there being cataclysmic Earth events or of their desire that they want to initiate some cataclysmic events to carry forward their agenda. Like, these elements do seem to have this kind of genocidal agenda on mind. Like, they're trying to fix mistakes cause starvation through destroying the food, nutrients.
Remember this, Chris. You and I and millions of other people are considered to be useless eaters by these people. And this is in an official Club of Rome report from the 1970s, which was discussing how to deal with what they call the overpopulation problem. Which basically, we're seeing this being action now. How are you doing up in Toronto with respect to chemtrails, by the way? You've got a lot of them up there?
I'm not really aware of the whole chemtrail thing. I don't really know anything about it, you know. Like, I mean, we've got a chemtrail. It's called Lake Ontario. It's full of toxic chemicals, and we're one of the most polluted cities in the world in terms of air pollution. But you're not allowed to smoke in restaurants, so everything's under control.
I mean, I don't know Toronto, but in Ottawa, I know before I came to New Zealand, there was at least twice a week where I could go out and see the chemtrails stretching from one end of the horizon to the other, and usually about 4 to 8 laying down of these trails through an afternoon and evening. And that was a regular thing in Ottawa, so I'm very familiar with it there, but I'm not familiar. It's amazing how many people never look up to the sky and realize that we're being sprayed. There was an interesting letter in your Uncensored, John, where one fellow was talking about his friend told him that he had kind of spoiled the sky for him, because now whenever he looked at the sky, he'd see this chemtrail spray, whereas before it was just the sky and it was nice and blue. And now you look up and you realize, oh, there they are. They're out of the game. Chemtrails are a curse on humanity.
Well, if you really want, let me turn you on to weatherwars.com, W-E-A-T-H-E-R, wars.com, one word, okay? Mm-hmm. And there you'll find a meteorologist who spends most of his time studying these chemtrails.
Oh.
And no, it's not Lake Ontario.
Oh, yeah.
This meteorologist has come up with some of the most interesting stuff that I've ever seen. Weatherwars.com will lead you to something called Operation Cloverleaf. Operation Cloverleaf, so-called because there are four aspects to it, one of which is geoengineering, one of which is turning the atmosphere into a plasma, because basically what they're spraying, two of the things they're spraying is micronized barium and micronized aluminium, which makes it very easy for all sorts of electrical and electronic of signal things to go through. One of them has to do with the HAARP project, H-A-A-R-P project, which is an ionospheric heater, which is basically a weather control mechanism situated in Alaska. H-A-A-R-P, for those of you who are not too familiar with what this is, they can aim billions of volts, pinpointed, and actually steer hurricanes and all sorts of other things. The other part of this Operation Cloverleaf, of course, is what they fondly call the Depop agenda. And what they found in some of the detritus from these chemtrails are not only micronized barium, micronized aluminium, but some mycoplasmas, viruses, assorted pathogens floating in a soup of bovine erythrocytes, which, of course, are white blood cells. How interesting.
Yeah.
So if I were you, Canada, I'd have a look up in the sky and have a look at what they're actually doing, because it's not exactly pleasant, but it's something that you should pay attention to.
And what's the purpose of
it? It amazes me, like, in a way, these people should be charged criminally with administration of a noxious substance. But where do you go? The police in Canada don't serve the people anymore. They protect these criminal elites. Like the RCMP and the CSIS, these people must know of these things, but they protect the people who are doing it. Like there's no enforcement of law anywhere. In a way, it's complete lawlessness. And these psychopathic groups control the police services.
Sure, that's right. They make the laws, and they enforce what they want to. They have the courts. They have the criminal justice system, which, of course, is aptly named. And there's basically no place to go except your own karma.
This is hardly a recent development.
No.
You know,
it's
always been that way. It's always been that way. It just has. I mean, you know, rich people and powerful people have always made the law, have always decided what's criminal and what's not criminal, and poor people have a better chance of going to jail than rich people. You don't see too many rich people in jail, you know? I mean, you just don't. I mean, historically, there's nothing new about this. That's something to keep in mind. But,
I think there are things that have very new in that ours is an age where these deviants have the technology and the technological capacity to actually affect some of their deviant schemes, whereas historically I don't think that's been as true. And I think
the truth
movement around the world is posing threat, because people are beginning to wake up. They're beginning to look at the patterns of history, learn the truth about 9/11, seek alternative media, in a way, we're at a very risky and precarious times.
But again, there's nothing new about that. If you study history, there's nothing new about people being on to people in power and how they're devious and how they do awful things. I mean, that the whole history of humankind...
Yeah, but wait a minute. Wait. Hang on for a second. Just because the phenomenon isn't new... What is your point? Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that at times that like when I hear people talk about this, and they attribute all sorts of schemes to people, they talk about it as if this is a relatively new phenomenon. But I'm saying no, it's not. I'm saying that
yeah. Well, so what? We're not saying that it's a new phenomenon. We're saying, yes, it's an old phenomenon with a new twist, and the new twist is
they can actually obliterate
all life on Earth.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah.
And they're undertaking things like the genetic modification of plants and experimentation and the weapons and the depleted uranium, all of these things are posing larger threat to the existence of life on planet Earth. I notice we're coming down to a few minutes left, and I'm going to try to begin to bring it to a close a little bit.
Let me sign off,
then. I'm going to come to you in a moment, Jonathan, sir. And I've been interviewing Jonathan Eisen of Uncensored Magazine. Jonathan's website is www.uncensored.co.nz. And I strongly recommend to people in North America, you can get a subscription to this magazine. It's like $40 a year, even. And it's very reasonable. It's a beautiful, an amazing magazine, high gloss, tons of information. I read them cover to cover. So outside of New Zealand, in the States, if you're not going to find it on your newsstand or in North America, I urge you to go to that site, subscribe to this magazine, and be spreading the word. That this is a very brave man we have here with us today, Jonathan Eisen. He has courage. And courage, I learned this last year, means a new heart. Somehow this man has found heart, and he's having courage to stand out there on the leading edge to try to expose these things that are happening in our times. Well, we just have a couple minutes left. I'm going to turn it over. Jonathan, sorry, anything you wanted to add? We have a couple minutes left.
Oh, my God, no. I don't have anything to add except to thank you guys for a stimulating interview, and I know it's stimulating because I didn't fall asleep when I was talking. it was most enjoyable, and I do thank you for the opportunity to come on your show. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, and I hope we'll have you back on at a later point. I hope next time you and I might be in the same place so we don't have that delay. And at times I have found it difficult hearing you, and I think if we were in the same space together, the interview might be able to flow more easily.
Yeah,
so
never know
Jonathan,
you're not.
And we'll have you back at a later date, and I do encourage people to go to your website. Okay, thank you, John.
Thanks,
goodbye.
Cheers.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks, John.
So, Jim, any last comments? I'm not sure exactly, but I think we only have a minute or so of time.
Yeah. Well, I'll just very quickly
anything
say
you wanted to.
Just thanks for having Jonathan on. That was very interesting. I hope he can come back. And I mean, there's lots of things that sort of came up in my mind listening to him that would be interesting to pursue on future programs. That'd be great.
He is just so knowledgeable about so many areas. And we'd have no trouble filling time. I had a dozen more things I would have liked to have asked him and talked to him about. Yeah, it was so interesting where he actually was involved